then they're going to come in here and testify if we're not done.
Oh, it was blue.
There we go.
Okay, there we go. Good afternoon again. I call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness, the Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It's Friday, September 23rd, 2 o'clock. Welcome. We've got just a couple of informational hearings with us today, so we're going to jump right into that. We're going to start, and I'm going to open an informational hearing on vehicle title fraud. And while Amy Joyce and Stephanie Zellner, if you guys want to come forward, I just want to reference this was brought to our attention due to some DMV cases that were in the Portland Tribune, which is kind of a small newspaper in the Portland metro area. And if you want to see those articles, they are actually on OLIS. Victoria put those on OLIS for us. So let's go ahead. Please introduce yourself and
Chair
proceed.
Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce. I'm a legislative liaison with the Department of Transportation here today representing the DMV. And with me is Stephanie Zellner. She's the manager of the vehicle section of DMV, and she's sort of the subject matter expert as we get into some of the nuances of some of this stuff. I'm going to defer to Stephanie quite a bit because it gets quite technical. But we were invited to come and testify today about title fraud in the area of what's called the possessory lien process. There has been that recent attention due to one specific case in the Portland area, but also attention just to the fact that this process exists and how those who are committed to committing fraud might exploit some of the holes or realities in this process, commit fraud and obtain a title to which perhaps they are not legally entitled. So first, some background. Oregon DMV processes over 1 million title transactions every year. The vast majority of these are going to be owner sale to a purchaser. So the owner signs over the title to a purchaser or gives a bill of sale, and that's how one usually thinks about how title transfers. The other way, far less common, is through operation of law. So perhaps there's a divorce judgment or some other court proceeding, and by operation of law, that title transfers. An extremely rare situation is foreclosure of possessory liens. And our estimates, we did some recent sampling of these transactions, perhaps one half of 1% of title transactions are this possessory lien. So what we have under Oregon law are seven different statutes covering seven different scenarios whereby a business or an individual is owed money related to that vehicle. The typical situation is a tower, but we also have mechanics. We have landlords who are owed money by their renter, sometimes a storage facility that's owed money by the lessor of that storage unit. What happens is a business, in a typical transaction, a business is owed money due to perhaps work on that vehicle or because of towing that vehicle. They're owed money, and so they send notification to the owner of record of that vehicle indicating the amount owed and why, and also that if that bill isn't paid by a particular time, the vehicle is going to be auctioned to cover that bill. Moving forward, if there's no response, the business goes forward and auctions that vehicle. And then that's the first time at which the transaction starts at the DMV. So now either the purchaser of that vehicle at the auction, or if there was no successful bid, the business itself, like the tower, would come to DMV, file an application for a new title along with this certificate of possessory lien foreclosure, and with that documentation, obtain title to the vehicle. In the past, DMV required, along with the certification, supporting documents, and DMV would scrutinize these documents. Several years ago, the Department of Justice advised DMV that it had absolutely no authority to do so, and in fact, and I will tell you this is quite rare, advised DMV to immediately stop doing that activity. And so DMV did stop. And so now what DMV does is simply accept this certification from the applicant, the entity who's either foreclosing that lien or the purchaser of that vehicle, accepts the certification that they've complied with the law, and the transaction goes forward. So what I think probably the next question is, what are we doing about it? What's happening? Because we know that there is some level of fraud in this situation. So the first thing we're doing is we're asking the Department of Justice for additional advice. This advice, where I indicated we were told to stop what we were doing, that advice is nearly 20 years old. So what we've done is asked DOJ, have there been any changes? Have the statutes changed? Has the case law changed? Has the legal analysis changed such that what we were doing in the past, perhaps we're not as constrained as the advice we received 20 years ago? What we're also asking is, you know, did we look at that advice too narrowly? Did we let the pendulum basically swing too far the other way? And there really are things that we can be doing, really, even under that advice, to give a little more scrutiny to these kinds of transactions to try to stop any fraud that might be sneaking through at this point. So that's the first thing. The next thing we're doing is we've sat down already with our industry folks. Again, towers are the vast majority of the folks who use this process, and in most cases use it completely legitimately. I mean, for example, many of these towers are towing vehicles at the request of law enforcement, and that's how that starts, but not in all cases. But so we're working with the industry on some solutions, and we have some ideas. Again, some of these are subject to what DOJ tells us we can do. But the first thing that we're thinking would be a simple, pretty process-oriented change is to centralize the analysis of these claims. So today, an individual, a business, a tower, for example, could walk into a DMV field office, hand over the paperwork, the person at the desk at the counter at DMV looks at it, oh, all looks good, maybe does some checks, whatever specific checks they do, and hand over plates and tags right there at the field office. Now, with the very tiny number of these things that come through in a year, perhaps 5,000, we've got 60 field offices, 400 employees. You might go a year as an employee of DMV and never see one of these transactions. You're hardly going to become expert at looking at what's supposed to be on there, what looks a little, you know, sketchy. And two, you're not going to see any kind of pattern or problem. So what we want to do is centralize this at headquarters. Now, that's going to be a little less convenient for businesses who are legitimately using this, but we think it's going to be a better way to analyze what's happening. So they'll come in centrally to headquarters. We'll have just a couple of people. They can become expert at what the laws are, what the processes are, what starts to look a little sketchy. I mean, people who work at DMV over time, they come very good at seeing something and going, that just doesn't look right, and maybe doing something about it. They can also start looking at patterns. Again, this gets back to that DOJ question, how far can we go? And that's what we're looking at. And so part of it is that issue, how far can we go in scrutinizing these documents? But another part of what we would do as part of that centralization is potentially creating a bit of a fast track for, you know, what might be considered, you know, trusted businesses. So you've got, you know, probably some towing companies that do quite a bit of these. We know who they are. They use the same address every time. They use the same phone number every time, perhaps the same staff every time. And we know that those folks are running, using this thing legitimately, so we don't have to scrutinize those as much. And that allows staff to spend more time on kind of the one-offs. Who's this business we've never heard of before? What's this out-of-state transaction? And spend more time on that so that we can efficiently use our time. Another idea has to do with just the forms that we use. So I mentioned there are seven different statutes for seven different scenarios. And four of these have to do with towers. So we've got towers using four different forms for four different scenarios. Maybe we consolidate that to one form. And then maybe also ask some additional information where a person who's, you know, just committing out-and-out fraud isn't going to know the information that the actual business would know. So we're going to work on that. We're going to work on it with the tow industry in partnership. So that we get the right information on there and not make it too onerous on them, but still be able to catch some of these perhaps sketchier, more questionable situations. So what else can we do? Well, there certainly are other things that could be done. I think any of them would take statutory change. You could explicitly give DMV the authority to verify, for instance, that the notices were sent to the owners of record. You could give us authority to scrutinize these things more than what DOJ has said we have the ability to do. In some states, the way they do this is there's basically a pre-foreclosure notice to DMV. So you sort of start the process at DMV, say, we're going to do this, and then they go out and do the notices and do the things. Some states require either a court order or owner sign-off, basically, to do this process. In some states, they allow for administrative hearings so that if there is an ownership dispute, that the resolution of that happens at the agency level in an administrative hearing. So those are all some things that happen in some other states. What I would say about those is anything that's done like that is obviously going to add more process, more time, more expense to those who use the process, and more time and expense to DMV to process them. So to our mind, you know, there is likely, the analysis would have to be a balance. Where do we balance tougher scrutiny and making absolutely certain no fraud occurs versus the expense and time expended on this kind of transaction, which I think that when the tow industry comes up, you know, they'll probably indicate to you that a lot of these vehicles are very low dollar value vehicles. There's not a lot of money to be made on them, but I'm sure they can speak to that better than I. So that's my kind of opening presentation for you, and we, of course, welcome any questions.
Did Stephanie want to testify before, or were you just here for other questions too?
Just questions.
Other questions, okay. Yes.
That was very thorough. We appreciate that. Any questions or comments?
Yeah. So, first of all, thanks for your testimony, first of all. How many cases of fraud are there every year?
Chair Fagan and Representative Nierman, I'll turn this over a bit to Stephanie, but when this first came out in the newspaper, a number of legislators asked me that very question, and we do have a fraud unit in DMV for both internal and external fraud investigations, and I think last year in 2015 they'd completed something, was it 3 or 5? Investigations, I think, was the number of where that it had been turned over to fraud. Now, I mean, we're not stupid. There's certainly some cases that don't get elevated to that kind of level, but that's the kind of level that we're aware of.
Less than 10 a year or something like that?
So. Yes.
Additional questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And next up, we'll have Jason Shaner and Al Elkins. Shaner, all right.
You can call me whatever you want. Just pop it.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed in whatever order you prefer.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me today is Jason Shaner, who's the president of our association. First of all, I'd just like to thank DMV for reaching out and talking to us about this issue. We've had the industry has a very good working relationship with them over the years, and they've been over backwards to set up special phone lines, special fax lines, special emails for us to get lien process information as quickly as we possibly can and efficiently as we possibly can. So we greatly appreciate that. We would like to work with DMV on this new process that they're establishing, and we've asked them to consider us a partner in this process. That concludes what I need to say, and Mr. Shaner has a couple of comments, and then we're glad to answer any questions.
So again, I'm Jason Shaner. I'm the president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and I own a towing company in Hood River in the Dalles, Oregon, so small town Oregon. So we really appreciate being a part of this so we can at least kind of give a real world how this works from the consumer and tow side. And like I shared with Amy, what normally happens, these cars come in from impounds, whether it be private property or the vast majority police. And, you know, we already have statutes and rules where we send out lien letters as soon as the cars come in, say, hey, we have your car. Most of it requires a notice. Most people do the lien at the same time because if you start separating the paperwork from the day-to-day to the stuff that's kind of in the back of the yard, you forget about it. And so, like, for ourselves, my company, we get the car in. As soon as the bill gets processed in the computer, we do a lien right there, send the notice, hey, your car is here. You know, this is the storage fee. This is how much it's going to cost. Some of the issues we do come into with the DMV issues are the owner of record is not correct. And that happens a lot, just because a lot of these cars that are being involved in police issues are abandoned. They were purchased from someone else. They did not get titled. They got a bill of sale, but they didn't get processed. So we send notices out. Most, 2-3 out of 10 come back. Undeliverable, no one there. So, you know, no one ever got those. And basically, you know, we send the process out. And probably of 10 cars that get towed, probably 5 to 6 get picked up. 3 are junk, literally scrap metal that we have to sit on the minimum time, and we take them to a wrecking yard. And again, I don't know if the paperwork actually processes through there, but we hand a lien and a foreclosure for crushing to them. They take it, and that's the end of it with us. And like I spoke with Amy at the DMV, you know, the towers are supposed to have a abandoned vehicle appraiser license on staff. I am one. Every tow company should have one. And like I told her, the companies that are doing police impounds and of any size should be regular players with the paperwork. So I suggested, again, whether we have a certain, right now the form says put your license plate on there. But again, anyone could look at any tow truck license plate and write that number down and you would know no difference. So again, if we gave a special number that we put on a form, that would be only in our office, that's great. If you want to make a little stamp that said, you know, the official form of Rivers Edge Towing and stamp it, at least that way when people are checking those, they can see it right away. It's not something a consumer or someone illegitimate could just write on a form. Simple solutions, but you know, they would definitely help. We definitely agree that the centralized location for doing these would be a big help because, again, any relationship with any DMV option with towing is very minor. It's something, even just my license plates, you can apportion your tow trucks for your weight mile tax versus just because we're on the Oregon-Washington border. So we do that, and that always becomes a big problem. I never get my stickers right. It's just unusual. It doesn't happen. And so I think, like you said, it's 1%. A special unit would be great. And to clarify, towers generally don't go to the DMV and register these cars because that's expense. And we're just selling them. We don't want them. So it's the consumer who actually takes the DMV paperwork in, gets the title and the keys and you know the plates and goes on. So like I spent the DMV, if they go to special processing, you just want to make sure that you have enough time on a temporary tag for them to legally drive while the process happens. Just for clarification. But again, we're just happy to be a part of it. I'm sure there are people who have no legitimate reason to fill out the form incorrectly or just make up something to steal cars with it, because if there's no check, there's no balance, that could happen. But we're definitely trying to make sure that the legitimate towers have an easy process. We really don't want 7 different forms that the dispatchers can grab the wrong one, or you know, there should just be to a tower, a car is a car. It makes no difference how it came in, it's a car, and it just they're coming in all the time, and so the process needs to be simple, it needs to be fast. You know, we talked about possibly like a dealer lot where they have to say, we have this vehicle in storage now, send it to DMV, but the cars come in, they go, and it's just so onerous that most cars, you know, the paperwork never gets back. And so you don't want to have a big pile of unflagged cars that never get processed, because then you have flags on all kinds of cars. Because again, you could just pay a DUI. But I still have to send my lien paperwork out because I don't know if you're coming back or not. These are all, you know, normal process things, but you don't want a flag on your car if you go to sell it because it got impounded 6 months ago. So but anyway, these are all just how the process actually works from the industry side. I'm happy to sit in on this and help kind of walk through that process. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Representative Nierman.
Mr. Shaner, for your testimony. How many possessory liens do you do a year, do you think?
Well, that's kind of a hard question because, I mean, every car that comes into my yard, I have to notify by law. So I send a lien on everyone because that way I don't forget to do it. So, but again, how many actually get foreclosed on?
No, so maybe you can break that down into two for me. So if I just park in the wrong parking lot and you impound my car, you're going to do a possessory lien. But then yes. I'm going to come see you the next day and say, hey, can I get my car back and pay you off?
Yes.
So how many of those? And then how many do you actually end up owning then?
I wouldn't know the exact number off the top of my head.
Sure.
I mean, I would say that, you know, depending on how the car comes in, like I say, if there's 10 cars towed, I would say that four to five actually get picked up.
So I know you already said that during your testimony. I was kind of wondering, like, the whole total for a year or a month or a period of time. I know you don't know that exact number, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm in rural Oregon, so there may be five police calls a month in Hood River, and there may be 10 in the Dalles. And the demographics are different. So in the Dalles, of those 10 cars, eight of them I might own. They might all just be yours because no one wants them.
But nobody in Hood River would ever let their car go.
Well, it does happen. You'd be surprised. Okay. Motorhomes just mysteriously show up that have no motor and transmission, and they show up in the highway. So I don't know how they get there, but they do.
I was going to say, as a graduate of the Dalles High School myself, why do you think more people in the Dalles aren't going to want their cars? Lots of great cars driving around there in the Dalles.
There are an amazing number of classic automobiles for sale all the time.
So yes, exactly.
Can I just ask one?
Yeah, go ahead.
So when you do execute a possessory lien and then end up owning the car, you said you sell them. How do you sell those? Do you do that on the Internet, or do you just put it in a lot somewhere? Or
no, what? Well, again, the vast majority are just taken straight to the crushers because their value is under $500. I don't want to try to even retail something that's $300. It's not worth the hassle.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So anything that's under that 500 window, usually as soon as the time's allowed, they just go to crush. Anything more than that is auctioned, usually by sealed bid. You know, and then we have a certain number of cars that we're allowed to sell to try to recoup our money. Like, I think it's 12.
So you have an auction contractor that you work with then?
We just do them ourselves. I mean, it's so small.
Oh, I see. So what do you do? Collect those up over time, and then when you get six or eight of them, do an auction?
Everybody does it differently. Some people do a lot of them. You know, they hold a bunch of cars. Some people just do one at a time. And so it just depends. Everybody does it differently.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's all the testimony that we had on the agenda today. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on vehicle title fraud and open an informational hearing on Department of Revenue collection practices. And while Deanna Mack and Marissa James are coming up, I will just note that this was an issue brought to us from a constituent, Chris Hallos, and his testimony, his kind of original note bringing that to our attention, is available on OLIS, thanks to Victoria. No Deanna with you today? Oh, she's already in seat. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, I'm Marissa James, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I draft in the area of garnishment.
And hi, I'm Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about our collection practices.
So I've looked at the letter from Mr. Hallos here, and I think he correctly represents what the law is in Oregon about wage exemptions, in that if you had just a regular creditor, there's a minimum amount that the debtor is allowed to keep, and if it's a state tax garnishment, then the Department of Revenue can garnish up to 25%. With no minimum amount. And just in looking at this issue, I note that it's basically compliant with federal law, which allows, in a regular debt situation, you can garnish 25% or 30 times the federal minimum hourly wage, which is the same as $218, which is the minimum amount under our Oregon statute. But that federal statute does not apply to state or federal tax garnishments. So the states are free to make whatever laws they want with regard to state tax garnishments. And Ms. Mack helped me come up with a brief survey of several other states. And there's some variety among the states in what they do. Some have the authority to garnish all of with no wage exemption. And some just stick to this federal standard. Some have a higher exempted amount. But it doesn't look like Oregon is particularly unusual in the way our statute works.
And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about our collections process itself, because a garnishment is actually one of the later stage tools we use. It's not something we immediately jump to right out of the gates. We offer different self-solution items for folks. So if you don't mind, can you page down through that?
Oh, yeah.
For me.
Do you want to sit here, or do you want me to just help you?
If you don't mind, that'd be great. So I just want to give you a quick overview of the collections process. Normally, it takes, we give folks up to a year to make payments for just about for all our individual tax programs before we even start considering to send it to a private collection firm. Sometimes we do send it earlier if they're already at a collection firm or we know that that's the best place. Maybe they're in a, they're maybe an out-of-state resident, that kind of thing. But generally what we do, if you don't mind, like next. The first thing is the debt becomes liquid and delinquent. And what happens in that case is they've received a bill. They've received, because they've self-assessed, you know, if you file on April 15th and you owe $50, we send you a bill. If you are under audit, you'll get a notice of deficiency and then you'll get a notice of assessment. If you don't file your returns and we ask you to file your returns, you're first going to get a request to file, and then you're going to get a notice in demand to file, and then you're going to get a bill. So that's the very first step. And that can sometimes take anywhere from, you know, if you self-assess, it can be pretty immediate. A deficiency assessment can be 30 to 45 days after the notice of deficiency is sent. And then a failure to file assessment can go anywhere from 90 days to 6 months, depending on how much the taxpayer works with us. Hopefully they'll file a return and we won't have to get to that point. Next step, the law requires that we send them a demand for payment for our tax programs. That is sent 30 days before we send a distraint warrant. We can record a distraint warrant. We don't have to record a distraint warrant, but the distraint warrant is the trigger that allows us to start garnishing if we need to. We don't always start garnishing, but that is the real high-level overview of the timing of, and the number of times a taxpayer is contacted before we get to the point where we might consider garnishment. Some of the statutory tools we have for, if you could, thank you, to resolve the debt, taxpayers have an option for payment plans. Obviously, there's active collections where we have, one of the tools is garnishment. We have penalty waivers. We have settlement offers that folks can choose from, temporarily uncollectible status, suspended collections, write-off, and cancellation. These are all tools you've given us to be able to resolve debt for debtors. The first one is a payment plan. That is listed in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. They're entitled to ask for a payment plan. If the department believes that it is in the best interest of the state to allow that to happen, then we generally enter into it. Most people can set it up online now themselves. They can contact us and ask for a payment plan. For individuals, it's automatic up to 12 months. If they say we can pay you in a year, then we automatically just say, sure, that sounds great, thank you. Businesses, and we also, our agency also collects for other agencies. Those folks get 6 months automatically. They can have extended payment plans if they submit a financial statement to show us their financial condition. Sometimes folks just don't want to pay us. They have the means to pay us. They just don't want to change maybe their lifestyle for a little bit. So we ask them to provide a financial statement so we can review it. Those can sometimes be approved all the way up to 24 months, sometimes 36 months if the conditions are worthy. We do have to have a manager approve that. But active collections often occur when a taxpayer does not engage with us or when they break a promised payment plan. We usually call the taxpayer first to explain what's going on, and then, but often they're calling us because they've got one of our notices. But like Marisa said, the notices of garnishment, we have, for Oregon, a notice of garnishment for a state agency acts to garnish 100% of the property that's in the possession, custody, and control of the garnishee. There are some exemptions, and so we call them a wage garnishment, and we call them a bank garnishment, because for wages, you've automatically exempted 75% of them from garnishment. So we can take, like Marisa said, up to 25%. Bank garnishment, we can actually take up to 100% of what's in the bank account. There are some exceptions for items such as Social Security, disability, unemployment. Those things are protected from garnishment. We do not take that money. And financial institutions, you passed a law in 2009 that said if a financial institution can tell that it's a Social Security deposit or an unemployment deposit, they don't even have to send it to us in the first place. There are protections in the law that allow us to allow a debtor to challenge a garnishment in case they think that we've taken income that's exempt from garnishment. But that law that passed in 2009 prevented that from actually lowered the number of times people have to challenge because banks don't send it in the first place. All Social Security is required to be deposited directly now, so banks know, financial institutions know that it's a direct deposit of Social Security. We have some other tools that we use for active collections. The Treasury Offset Program is a program with the federal government where, we've participated since 2001. The TOP, we call it, is a Treasury Offset Program that allows our agency to offset a taxpayer's federal income tax refund to pay their debt. That happens even if they're in a payment plan. That's something that we offset of refunds will always happen even if they're in a payment plan, and we tell folks that up front to expect that to happen. We also have the state income tax levy program that I don't have on the slide, but that's where the IRS sends us a levy and we send the Oregon refund to the IRS. It always has to be reciprocal with them. The other thing is we have just in 2011, you passed a law that allowed the department to work with the federal government to enter into a federal vendor offset process. So we're not just looking at tax refunds anymore. We're looking at vendor payments that we just implemented with our new computer system in December of 2015. So that's brand new. And then the last thing we do is the law requires us to send accounts to a private collection firm after a year of us trying to collect actively where we haven't received a payment from them, then we're required to send it to a private collection firm. Often accounts that we decide go to a private collection firm are out-of-state debtors. Like I said, debtors who already have an account with a private collection firm, maybe a smaller balance, where it's maybe not cost-effective to send it to a field agent to collect on, and then sometimes when all of our other collection efforts have been exhausted. But these are, again, all advanced type of collection tools. We're looking at, taxpayers have an ability to self-resolve before we even get into this to these kinds of things. We also have authority to, these are what we consider really advanced collection tools where we're really evaluating the business. They're really trying to avoid paying us. Usually it's a business. A till tap would be somewhere where we have the sheriff go and seize the contents of a till at a restaurant or a bowling alley or wherever it is that they might be. We don't do it very often. We have done it. We don't do it very often. We use it very judiciously. Same with the personal property seizures. We can have safe deposit boxes drilled. We can have vehicles seized. But we, again, use it very judiciously. We never take a first vehicle from someone if it's their only vehicle. We're only looking at second, like boats or boat trailers or that kind of thing. We don't want to leave them without a way to get to work. That's counterintuitive. We can require sales, stock sales, if they own stock, have them liquidated to pay debt. And then we can also suspend a license if someone has not paid. We have a lot of folks who do that. We generally send a notice of intent to suspend, and this is a tool that we use after every other collection effort we have made has failed. So we will send a notice of intent to suspend the license, and almost in all cases that is what that gets them to come up with the money to pay us. Another incentive that we use in our collections process to get folks to pay us is an offer of a penalty waiver. There are penalties for failure to file, and there's penalties for failure to pay. Some of those penalties can be waived if people do, we kind of say if you do these things, if you pay this debt, we can waive up to a certain amount. And so if they get down to where their balance is the amount, say they have, we've agreed to waive $500 penalty, they get their balance down to $500, we'll go ahead and waive the penalty for them. It promotes a long-term effectiveness of the tax system because we don't want to just, nail people. That's not our intent. We try to get people in compliance long-term. We recognize sometimes there's a circumstance beyond their control. Maybe there's a fire or a death in the family. We ask them for circumstance, to show that those things happen. In those cases, we waive all of the penalty. Sometimes if they've been a good actor and they just have oops, I didn't realize I didn't file that return. I thought my CPA did it. It's in my return in my file cabinet. I'm really sorry. We'll give them that one free bite at the apple. We call it a one-time waiver. They can choose any penalty, the highest amount on that one-time waiver. We don't say it has to be the first time. It can be whatever is the most expensive. But we do give them some grace and recognize that, you know, people are human and they make mistakes. But we do use that to help with collections as well. So a taxpayer that doesn't have the means to pay at all or has very limited means can offer a settlement. Those folks need to pretty much not have any assets or any ability to borrow against any assets to be able to pay. It's generally more difficult to collect the debt. We do require a good faith down payment of 5% of their offer, not 5% of the amount that they owe, but 5% of their offer. We do require that they stay in compliance going forward so that they, so at the end of that period, then we'll cancel the debt entirely. Once, and for that one, they can't also be in bankruptcy or litigation under that one. We also have an ability to put someone who's just temporarily lost their income, their source of income, into a hold status. We call it temporarily uncollectible. Most of the time when we see folks that are in this situation, it's because they've just become unemployed. They're looking for work. They don't have a means to pay us for a short period of time, so we'll put them in temporarily uncollectible status, but we foresee that they will have an ability to pay in the future. So we expect that, you know, their financial condition would probably improve in the next 90 days to 6 months. Suspended collections is a new tool that was offered in 2000, this last session, I think, where certain low-income debtors who only have an income source from a protected asset that's protected from garnishment, like Social Security or disability, that kind of thing, can get put into a hold status for 1 year, so their debt can just sit there for a year. We will look at it every year to make sure they still qualify. If they sit in that period of, these are for folks that we wouldn't already consider for cancellation, because a lot of the lowest income folks, we just know that there's not a chance that we are ever going to collect the debt. Their circumstances may have changed. We had a lot of this with the dot-com boom. A lot of people had a lot of gains because of that in the 90s, and then all of a sudden they had no jobs, and they don't have a means to pay the debt anymore. So we work with them to try and figure out what's the best solution for them. Most of these require that they have a financial statement submitted to us, and then we kind of work to see which of the paths is the best way for them to resolve their debt. After 3 years of no collection activity, the law allows us to put these accounts into what's called write-off status. And what that does is it takes it out of our AR. But if it comes into a point in time where we find that they do have a means to pay, like they've sold a home or they've gotten a job in Oregon, we can tell from our employment reports they've got a means to pay, then we'll reinstate it from write-off and start collecting on it again. Cancellation is our last ditch effort, and that is where we just outright cancel it, and because for a couple of reasons. One, it's too costly to collect the debt. Our cost to collect it exceed the balance. That'll happen sometimes if they're out of state and we have to engage law, the AG, to get a special AG for in another state. It starts to become very expensive and might not be worth collecting the $300 that they owe us when we have to pay $1,000 to do that. So the law allows us to do that. We also can cancel it after all of our active collections have been exhausted, the taxpayer's location is unknown, or they're deceased, or the tax is completely, wholly uncollectible. That is seven, the tax has been delinquent, and the tax has to have been delinquent for 7 or more years. If we cancel it, it is forever extinguished. We will not reinstate it. So those are some of the ways that we can resolve debt for taxpayers. But the big thing I wanted you to understand is that by the time we get to a garnishment, the taxpayer has a lot of opportunities to self-resolve before we get to a point in time where we have to start doing enforced collections. It is a tool we use. It's a tool that many agencies use. It's not unique to Department of Revenue. But that's where I wanted to share with you today at a real high level. So if you have any questions.
Questions or comments about the presentation? Anyone other than Representative Holvey?
I apologize, Deanna, if I missed this, but In terms of the Social Security deposits or disability deposits go into the bank that you can get 100% of the bank account except for those, I guess my question is, what is that exempt amount? Is it the total aggregate of all Social Security deposits in the past, or is it limited to a certain time period, or is it one payment that's exempt?
Madam Chair.
Because I could have 5 years of deposits that I could claim are all exempt, and that's the amount of my 100% of my bank account.
Right. Representative Holby, I believe that there's a limit. There is a look-back window. I believe it's, I want to say 2 months. I don't know if you know that off the top of your head. There is a look-back window, so it's the financial institutional look-back in that window. And I believe they go with a first-in, first-out type of philosophy when they do that evaluation. But I believe that the cap is anything that's above $7,500 is no longer exempt.
No follow-up.
No follow-up. Well, the second part of my question, just teasing. Are you able to, you mentioned you are able to get stocks as well. Can you go after stocks that are held in IRAs?
Madam Chair and Representative Holby, we can't go after retirement funds or annuities. That's also a protected item, pensions. So I believe that if we know that that's what the fund is, like if it's an IRA and it's got mutual funds or something like that, we won't.
Representative Dearman.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Mack, for the presentation. So I imagine that a lot of these people, if they're in trouble with the state of Oregon, they're probably in trouble with the federal government, too, or that's probably fairly common. Mm-hmm. So how does that work? You get to take 25% of the wages once you get to the garnishment thing, and then do you get in line behind the feds, or do you go concurrent with them? Or
so, Representative Fagan and Representative Nierman, there are priority. So whoever's first in time is first in line. So if we get our garnishment in first, then our garnishment would be the one that would pay. If the IRS gets in front, then that's the one that pays. We do work with folks, though. We do work with them to negotiate a lower percentage based on what other obligations they have. But they have to come to the table. They have to tell us what their financial situation is so that we can work with them. But I've personally reduced garnishments down to 5% of the amount of the monthly of their salary. Yeah. So it just depends because it made financial sense for the state. Because it covered the amount of interest that was still accruing on their account every month, and it was a means for them to come to an end and resolve their debt. But we didn't take the whole 25%.
Thanks.
But they have to come to the table to talk to us.
Any other questions or comments? My only question is, if you were auditing someone's taxes, is there anything that would prevent that person, hypothetically, if they're running for president, from releasing their tax returns? I'm joking. You don't have to answer that. Because that would never happen, obviously. That would never happen. Any other questions or comments?
Are you running for president?
I can now. I'm 35.
Her daughter, me.
All right. Without that, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Department of Revenue collection practices. And anything else for the good of the order? I know Victoria had one thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I just wanted to point out that I have set this background brief packet in front of you on the dais just to make you aware that our office does produce background briefs. The current background briefs are listed along with the website where you can access them, and I also included a sample on short-term loans for your information.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Anything else for the good of the order? Mr. Chair or Vice Chair Bueller, do you have anything?
Just being glad to come to an end.
All right, me too.
Happy
right.
birthday.
Happy Thank
birthday.
You. With that, I'm going to close the informational in the interim House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. From House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.